I think it's exciting that we're seeing reports from so many different parts of the world. So I'll be speaking to you about multiple element limitation in northern hardwood ecosystems. I have many co-authors, and I'll be reporting the work here of several of them. I do very little of this myself besides organize the conference calls. So I don't need to introduce Lee Biggs Barrel, except to credit Steve Perakis for telling us that Sprengel had it first, and to point out that nitrogen is the element that we always think should be limiting first. Even though we know that we've been adding nitrogen to ecosystems since the Industrial Revolution, and that at some point something else could become limiting, I'm rooting for phosphorus. This is the location of the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest. They're all laughing. Oh. So I started working at Hubbard Brook 30 years ago with a dissertation on phosphorus cycling. So my goal today is to find out whether phosphorus is every bit as important as nitrogen in this co-limited system. Nobody put up this slide yet, maybe because all of you are critical of it. Of the terrestrial ecosystems included in this meta-analysis, only four of them are forests, and none of them have a full factorial nitrogen and phosphorus addition. Steve showed this too. Matt Badabunker found 35 studies in northern hardwoods that had different nutrient additions, none of them a full factorial nitrogen and phosphorus. I'm sorry to report that to nitrogen alone, there's a greater response than to phosphorus alone. And in both cases, there's a greater response when other nutrients are added. So there's definitely stuff going on with more than one nutrient. Ed Rastetter is involved in this project. He had a multiple element limitation model that had two elements, nitrogen and carbon. And now he's added phosphorus. Somebody asked about other resource limitations. So light, water are included now. And the idea is that plants allocate effort to get these different resources depending on what's more limiting. So we applied this model to a secondary successional northern hardwood forest and did simulated nutrient additions at different ages. And I want you to see that at some ages, there is a greater response, according to the model, to phosphorus alone than to nitrogen alone. So if you're interested in this paper, he shows how effort varies over the course of succession. And the response to both elements together is always the best. Here's what our experiment looks like on the ground. There's 13 stands spread over three sites. Two of them are maybe boutique sites. In stands of different ages, so zooming in at Bartlett Experimental Forest, we have three ages, three replicate stands of each site, and within each of those we have the full factorial nitrogen phosphorus, neither or both. And in five stands we also have a calcium addition, which I won't talk to you about now, but I know some of you are interested. That was Mark Green's addition. So we're adding nitrogen, phosphorus, calcium, nitrogen, phosphorus annually at 30 or 10 kilograms per hectare per year. Calcium was a one-time addition of calcium silicate. I'm going to talk to you about four different studies looking at different nutrient or resource interactions. So beginning with foliar resorption, this is Craig C.'s master's thesis. Nutrients resorb nutrients. Trees resorb nutrients from leaves before they drop the leaves. And this is really important. It can meet half of the nutrient requirement for the year. We can report the resorption efficiency, amount resorbed relative to what was in the leaf, or we can look at the concentration in the leaf, which is called resorption proficiency. If you were thinking about one element, you would expect that resorption should be highest where the nutrient is in short supply and should decrease with availability of that nutrient. And sometimes that's seen, sometimes there's no relationship, sometimes it goes the wrong way altogether. Why would resorption increase when the availability of the nutrient increases? Well, maybe because we need to look at more than one element. So if an element is limiting, maybe another element should be, as nitrogen availability increases, say, the demand for phosphorus should become higher and more effort should be devoted to phosphorus limitation. So that's what we're going to look at here. This is based on 18 plots in 6 of the stand at Bartlett, because those are the ones where we have quantitative soil pits. So we're going to compare foliar resorption to soil concentrations, comparing green leaves shot in August to senescing leaves caught in October. So first, litter nitrogen concentrations are not predicted by either soil nitrogen or soil phosphorus. And they don't vary all that much. Nitrogen resorption turns out to be less variable than phosphorus resorption. So phosphorus resorption relates to soil nitrogen with greater resorption at low nitrogen. And then, because nitrogen and phosphorus are correlated, we get that counterintuitive relationship where we have higher phosphorus resorption where soil P is high. The next thing Craig did was take all these different species and weight them by the proportion of masses in our litter baskets. And we get this really nice relationship. Again, litter phosphorus resorption efficiency increases with soil nitrogen, or concentration proficiency decreases with soil nitrogen. And they look similar for carbon and phosphorus. So I'm sorry that phosphorus resorption responds to soil nitrogen and not the other way around, but we have a nice nutrient interaction here. Next, we'll look at soil respiration, which you could think of as carbon allocation to acquire nutrients. Kikong Bay was monitoring soil respiration prior to our treatments. So this is 13 stands, all 13 stands, and they differ quite a bit in native soil fertility. So Melanie Fisk collects, I believe this is OA Horizon material, incubates it for nitrogen mineralization, and indeed soil respiration is higher where nitrogen availability is lower. So there's a trade-off, carbon for nitrogen. Starting post-treatment, young, mid, and old stands at Bartlett, there is a reduction in soil respiration when you add nitrogen or phosphorus, or both, more so for nitrogen, especially in the young stands. And Tim Fahey did this, comparing the respiration in the nitrogen addition as a ratio with the control. Respiration decreases the most when you fertilize it, where nitrogen availability was already lowest. And I tried graphing those data with phosphorus availability on the x-axis. Nothing. So again, a nice trade-off, but no evidence that phosphorus is more important than nitrogen. How about enzymes? So phosphatase enzymes could help you get phosphorus if you got plenty of nitrogen to make proteins. And indeed, again, we have Melanie's nitrogen mineralization on the x-axis here. There is greater phosphatase activity where nitrogen availability is high across all our stands. And phosphorus availability follows phosphatase activity. I asked her about nitrogen mining enzymes. So no polyphenol oxidase nor glucosidase relates to the availability of phosphorus and soil. So I was hoping we'd see greater effort for nitrogen acquisition where phosphorus availability is high. This isn't published yet. They're still working on it. Maybe they'll find something. Finally, this is the availability of soil nutrients upon fertilization. So this is at the very beginning of our fertilization, where there's not yet a feedback from the trees, so this should tell us what's going on with soil soil microbes. As you would expect, if you add nitrogen, there's an increase in nitrogen availability. And if you add phosphorus, there's an increase in phosphorus availability. And the cool thing is, if you add both, there's an even greater increase, especially for the effect of phosphorus on nitrogen availability. So either there's reduced uptake of nitrogen when we also add phosphorus, or there's increased mineralization when we add phosphorus. We don't know which, but it's another interaction between the nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. In summary, Foliar resorption of phosphorus responded to soil nitrogen more than nitrogen resorption did to phosphorus. Soil respiration reflected soil nitrogen, but not soil phosphorus. Soil phosphatase activity responded to nitrogen availability, not the case for soil nitrogen acquiring enzymes. And soil availability of nitrogen depended on phosphor addition more than availability of phosphorus depended on nitrogen addition. I lose, but many interesting results. I usually end this talk by inviting people to work at our sites. We want to keep these going forever, and there's lots of things to be measured. I had a conversation yesterday with Steve Prakas, who said we should be doing these experiments at lots of sites. So I want to say, start a N plus P factorial experiment at your site. Please talk to Steve Prakas. And he put up this slide, which is Joe Crane's book. I hadn't seen it, but I think it explains the confusion I had expressed to Mary Beth about what constitutes, how would we recognize co-limitation. So if we can do lots of studies and lots of types of sites, I think we'll see lots of types of co-limitation. Thank you. Yes.
Well, speaking of interactions, we often see an addition of a nutrient, calcium, phosphorus, or whatever. But in particular, depending on how it's added, if you add lime, it's not a calcium fertilization. If you add a lot of phosphate, it's not a phosphorus fertilization per se. Phosphate is an excellent liming material and stimulates microbial activity the same way lime does, which liberates nitrogen, which might make that more available. So there's a lot of interactions other than just the nutrient-nutrient interaction, depending on the material. You add phosphate in different forms, diammonium phosphate, monoammonium phosphate, big effects on pH. How can we separate those when we're trying to just understand nutrients themselves?
It'd be nice to do more controls. I didn't point out, but we did a monosodium phosphate because all the phosphate fertilizers have calcium in them. And I got this recommendation from Steve. And it's called neutral sodium phosphate. But if you wanted to, and then the reviewers, you're adding sodium. You know, what's the effect of adding sodium? Adding sodium has an effect on soil. So it'd be nice to do some additional controls so you could tease those things out. Are we really looking at a phosphorus addition effect? Are we looking at a salt addition effect, right? Or, yes, I agree. Yeah.
All of these sites, they are moderately well-drained soils, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, you know, I was looking, who is Jason? Yeah, you had your classification and your possible factors, and I thought, ooh, those look like the soil-forming factors, and where's slope position? But drainage, you had drainage as one of those important factors. So, yes, we like to think that our sites are similar initially in soils, and then we find we have these huge variations in nitrogen availability that we can't explain. Another student looked at parent material, and there seems to be more nitrogen in the samples that are formed on the sites that have more schist and less granite. So we want to start analyzing those rocks we saved out of the soil pits. I keep talking to Scott about that every year. It's a lot more fun to write proposals. I had this conversation too with Steve yesterday than papers because they're so messy. So yeah, in the proposal, the nitrogen is coming from the surface and the phosphorus is coming from depth, and we're going to see differences in where roots are deployed or where the mycorrhizae are or which ones, and we're trying, but there's such high variability that's really hard to see. We do have Joel Bloom, I didn't mention, is one of our collaborators, and he and Melanie Fisk buried appetite mixed with sand to see if they can see who's going after appetite and whether there's a difference by, you know, in the sites in which we have more or less nitrogen or phosphorus limitation. We don't know the answer.
Okay, with that, let's take any more questions for the end. And we have...